And we're live. Hey, folks, thanks for tuning in to the BAM Podcast. I'm your host, Mike Lafferty. And today is Writers Wednesday. And with us are two writers, Walt Rebilliard over on this side. Say hi, Walt.
Hello.
Hi, Walt. And Walt has several audio and ebooks coming out. Is it this next year, 2021?
I'm not sure of the schedule. It all depends on the narrators and stuff. So,
okay.
But I've done short stories with Keystroke Medium. I've done short stories with Bayonet Books. We have the prelude to my trilogy coming out. That's done in both. That's both digital and audio. So, yeah, we got quite a few things out there.
All right, cool. And if someone wants to pick up, someone's been watching our podcast on Wednesdays, goes, and says to themselves, you know, that Walt, I like the cut of his jib. How would they pick up your prelude to your series when it comes out?
Oh, they just go to hazardstudio.net, and it's right there.
Oh, can't beat okay. It. There we go. Fair enough. And Ryan Danks, just since we're giving Walt's resume, we'll give yours to. You are Mr. Jade Punk.
Good enough.
Wildly successful fake Kickstarter, and you've been transitioning to fiction. And in between, you're doing a lot of writing on Medium.com. Is that a fair summary?
Yeah, that's pretty close. Getting into the Kindle short reads, learning how to publish, but using mostly nonfiction. Taking my Medium articles and transitioning to Kindle Unlimited.
Okay, cool. How's that? Have you made that jump yet?
Yeah, I've got. I put out my second nonfiction book, third nonfiction book last week.
Oh,
so okay. They're all tiny, like 4,000 or 5,000 words.
Mm-hmm.
40 pages I think is my longest one. It's a martial arts beginner's guide I wrote 4 years ago.
Oh, I bought that when my kid was joining karate.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, cool. Just a couple years ago. I liked it. It gave me some advice on, you know, what to avoid and things to look for and that kind of thing.
Cool. So, that was the idea.
Yeah. And I'm Mike Lafferty, and I aspire to write sometimes, but I struggle with one of my biggest struggles to get into our topic today, which is pantsing versus outlining. And if you've never heard those phrases before, pantsing is flying by the seat of your pants, which is just you sit down and you effing write. And outlining is the other side of the coin, where you want to outline your scene breaks, your beats, your transitions. And this is something I've got a bunch of stories I've been working on that I occasionally talk to Walt about. And a lot of them are outline form. Then I fill in the outline and kind of tinker with it. And I like it because it gives me a structure to work with. And I experiment with different kinds of story structure, like, you know, the old Dan Harmon story wheel versus more of a 7X structure versus, you know, there's a few different kinds of outlines out there. But I sometimes worry if it's just another form of procrastination, you know, sort of like getting all your cleaning supplies organized before you clean the kitchen. So, Ryan, you said you struggle with this too?
I do. The only things I've ever finished were pants or a thing that James Scott Bell coined. I think it was D.L. Doctorow or something like that, called Headlights Method, where you write a scene and then you imagine that your car is driving on a long road on the night and you can see as far as your headlights go. So you write a scene and then you have a good idea of what comes after it. So you write a paragraph for that and you have a kind of a decent idea of after that. So you maybe write a one sentence for the next scene or two, and then you write that scene and you've moved your car up into that. And then you flesh out the next ones and you're always only outlining the next one to two scenes. That's the only thing that I've finished is something like that, where it's basically pantsing with a little bit of direction. But I do, like, I think like you, maybe procrastinate and I start thinking, well, what if I get the story wrong? So let me outline and get all the story beats and then I never write it cause I'm bored. Cause I know it.
Mm-hmm.
And I vacillate back and forth. That's probably why I'm not getting anything done.
So, Walt, you're a diehard pantser, and my God, you write a lot. So, tell us how it works for you, and have you ever dabbled in outlining, or is that just bad mojo you don't get mixed up with?
No, I'm kind of a little bit of a hybrid. I mean, I usually say that I'm, you know, a dark writer. You know, there's another expression for pantsing, so writing into the dark, or, you know, writing by the seat of your pants, or what have you. But what I'll do is I always carry a notebook with me at some point. You know, even if it's just my phone to tap out ideas and stuff like that. So what I'll do is rather than doing an outline, I'll do like plot points. you know, and plot a story, you know, like in the upcoming book that we have coming out through Aethon Books. The title is Hunter's Moon, The Mongrel. And the idea came out of the idea that initially Darth Maul, who was this amazingly designed character aesthetically, like to look at him, you got the sense of just from his look what he was all about and how he was going to be used in the story. And then, you know, 5 minutes of growling and he gets chopped in half and that's all you see of him until Dave Filoni resurrects the characters during the Clone Wars cartoons.
And I just, that's what Dave Filoni does. He brings back stuff George Lucas messes up.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's like if you ever saw Battle Angel Alita, you know, or just Battle Angel, if you just watched the anime and never read the comics, you know, here was this discarded thing that, you know, this guy goes into a junk pile and is like, I can't believe somebody threw this away. This is a treasure. And, you know, it eventually becomes, you know, this huge deal. So I was thinking to myself, and it was right around the time that we had a big family tragedy going on. And I was just kind of in my own head to kind of pull myself out of that funk. And I said, you know, what would be really cool if there was like a Darth Maul character or something like that, that, wasn't totally evil, but like, you know, had some questionable morals. What if you had like John Wick straight in the middle of the Clone Wars, you know, like straight up, you know, here was this dude, he had this wicked life before. And there was, you know, there was something that had kind of pulled him away from all of this murder and that thing dies. What's left to keep the universe safe? And in the midst of where all that redeeming goes on, those allies that he's had or brought together with him, where, how do those follow him on his path of revenge? Is there still redeeming qualities about him? That was the first line, you know, what if John Wick was in the middle of the Clone Wars? You know, and right from there, in my head, the rest of it just started, you know, kind of working out from there. I just started writing, and I kind of do like reverse outlines, almost like story Bibles backwards. When something hits the page, I write it down. That way I can refer back to it later. And I use kind of like a spreadsheet with a search function so that if I need to refer back to it later, I can do that. I don't outline like, you know, in section 4, paragraph 3, he's going to scratch his nose and something's going to happen. And I can't do that.
How much do you know in advance before you get going?
I do it like a good role-playing game. I know everything that's going to happen until I sit down to write.
So you have like a hook and a concept of where it's going to go, but
that's it. You know, yeah. Like the front of my book that's coming out, initially was a little bit different. I had a scene where you meet the main character you meet one of the main characters in the beginning, and it's just him walking down a hallway. And you know, the editor got back to me and said, you know, I see what you're doing here, but we're not like, you're not hooking me right away. And then that combined with rewriting and redrafting the first manuscript so it worked more with audio, because I had chapters that were very short and they were like, you know, people when they listen to audio, we found in our experience that a longer chapter is a little bit easier, so you're not just constantly transitioning through chapters. Can you do something with that? So the original draft of the book, you met a character walking down a hallway, and there was, the scene was being set as, and you were kind of being exposed to the world through different elements he was seeing as he's walking through different parts of the hallway going to the control center. So after I restructured the book, it instead focuses on the John Wick dude, and you see two parts of his life. You see him before and the anarchy and chaos he was in before. And then you meet him in the right now at the same time that the dude is walking down the hallway and things have gone horribly wrong. And it, in the beginning, I was just like, man, I don't see what the problem was. You know, this guy doesn't know what he's talking about. But once I, after I redraft something, I always throw it back on my phone and listen to it. Because I found that A, I'm going to hear 10 times more of the mistakes from listening to it, than just reading it. And also, you get a good sense of the flow, whether or not the story works, because, like that spoken, being told a story versus reading it yourself, you just get a sense of flow that you're not going to get just by reading it. And I do anyway. And, I was like, you know, God damn it. this guy was onto something. Yeah. This works a lot better. And I think introduces the story in with a more significant hook. Whereas, you know, in the beginning, you just have this guy with these hard military boots walking down a hallway. And each step is like the impending step of doom for that other character. But you haven't met him yet. You know, in this way, you get both. You meet the character and you know that, you know, what's going on is heading for him at a rapid pace. And it worked really well. So I was very glad and appreciative of the editor for him doing that and kind of noticing that. And it worked out to the benefit of the story, I think.
That was a cool anecdote. We could just put the whole podcast around that.
But yeah, you know, stuff like...
But what's interesting, like... what's his name? James Patterson. I did his masterclass years ago, but I've done it several times. And then he says that beginning writers mess up because they don't write an outline, and his outlines are pretty detailed. But then you have like Neil Gaiman, who says sometimes just all you do is sit down and write the next word. And it's interesting to see how even like Stephen King and will be adamant that you're an amateur if you outline, and then James Patterson will say you're an amateur if you don't. It really is just like every writer has a unique way.
Yeah, it's a personal preference, because at the end of the day, it's art. You know, you have to you're producing art, and art is a very personal, very very primal thing on a native level that it's just going to go into your personal preference. I mean, Van Gogh isn't going to draw the same way as like Jim Lee.
Right.
You know, it's just, it's technical differences, style differences, the personality of the artist or the writer, because at the end of the day, that personality is kind of what fuels the story.
Mm-hmm. You know, so there was an interesting, I played with this in the past and I really liked how it came out. If you watch Netflix, and I know Daredevil does it. They were the first ones to do it because it's a blind character. They wanted to have a blind audience. So you can set the setting where it is for the visually impaired, I believe is what it is. And anything that happens that's not dialogue or obvious that it's happening, a narrator will say it. Like Matt throws his stick, whatever they called him, or baton, and it bounces off a thing and smacks a bad guy. And it's like, so I got this idea when I watched the first time. I accidentally turned that on, and I was like, this is like an outline with dialogue. So I wrote a screenplay for a story that I was working on, and it was a short story, and I wrote a screenplay basically as though I were writing for a visually impaired. And then I took that screenplay and I narrated it into prose form. And long form, and made all those quick descriptions prettier. And it was one of the stories I was most proud for, because a screenplay is basically an outline with dialogue. So that was a lot of fun, but it was supposed to be serial, and I never wrote the second one. So I don't know if it's an interesting concept, though, because you're pantsing it in screenplay form, which is far easier to edit because it's far fewer words.
Yeah, sure.
And then when you get everything down, you're like, okay, I like this structure. Converting it to prose is also very easy because all your dialogue is done, all your description is done. Now you're just making it a little bit prettier, going into their heads where it was first person or it was present tense. You're going past tense.
That's a good tip. I'm going to try that because your writing scripts is a lot easier for that reason.
Yeah, I write scripts very easily. I can finish a script. I have a hard time finishing a prose story.
You know what it is for me? I have some energy about people talking to each other. It's interesting to me. Just innately, I want to, people are having a conversation, I want to listen in. When that stops happening, it's just like one dude doing something and I got to write what he's doing. I don't give a shit.
That's, so, you know, that might be a, oh, go ahead, please.
No, no, no. Go for it.
I was going to say that might be your inner artist kind of hammering on the door and telling you third person is not for you. You need to be writing in first person.
Yeah, it could be that too. Well, I'll try to take both those things. Hey, successful podcast. Go ahead.
My daughter brought up, and we were watching this Disney thing, but she was like, it's so weird that the most impactful moments are so short. And then there's all this dialogue and everything else after, because she's really creative. And so I told her, I was looking at that and I was like, you know, it's true. In like, if you think of what's something super impact. So Thanos's snap, right? Mm-hmm. The build up to that and the reaction to it is way more important than the 10-second moment of him and Thor sitting there with the snap. It's the reaction to big things or the fear of big things happening, but the big thing should not take that long. The action should be quick, because it's the bill, it's the fear of it, the anxiety of it, and then the reaction, the consequences of it that are story. The thing just it either ignited it or was something you wanted to prevent.
There's
Coen
Brothers movie, No Country for Old Men. And they do a weird thing in the finale, the conclusion, the climax of that movie. They don't show you the final fight scene. They just show you the aftermath. And it's a weird stylistic choice. A lot of people hate it, but I can kind of see what they're doing, because now, especially in life, how often are you there for the big fight that determines the course of someone's life or the end of someone's life? Usually you're dealing with the consequences and the fallout.
That's so, did it happen before the movie began?
I'm trying, it's been a few years since I've seen it, but I want to say they just cut away from it, and then, you know, it was a time cut, and when they cut back, you know you just got the scene of what happened, and the cops are there, and they're, you know, people are...
So that gives me a little bit of validation then. My story that's on Amazon right now, Bushido, the number one thing that groups that I've kind of pitched that to, it's a short story, they're always like, this story is Bushido, but it begins after the fight. The guy's dead on the ground. And I'm like, and they're like, I really feel like this story should have started with, I mean, there's a sword fight later. You get the sword fight. But it was like the aftermath of that was mattered. I always like kind of stuck to it artistically. Like, no, it's his reaction, his emotional reaction to it that is important because of who it was that he killed. But everyone was like, no, this story should start with a fight. So I like that. Then
it's I need to point out that a lot of critics hated that.
Did they?
I can understand the reasoning for doing it, and from a story point of view, I think I don't remember if I liked it or hated it when I saw the movie myself, but it kind of stuck with me as that's the weirdest way I've seen someone end a movie, especially, you know, there was one of these Coen brother villains, you know, who was kind of, you know, elemental force of violence coming for the protagonist, and you just knew something bad was going to happen, and then they don't show it to you.
You know, speaking of movies and script writing, one of the things that should be pointed out is one of the major differences between like movies and scripts versus prose and novels. If you really want to drive your editor bananas and also bore the ever living shit out of your readers, have them turn a lot and breathe a lot and nod, lots of nodding. You know, he turned and had and breathed a heavy sigh. Who cares?
Yeah.
You know, that's what's called stage direction, and it's mostly done for script writing so that you can put dramatic motion into a scene. Having it in a novel, you end up with tons of turning and breathing and looking, and you're not leaving anything to the imagination of the reader. Now, there are times when you're going to need to put it in. you know, like hearing an alarm forcing a character to turn right in the path of something, or, you know, breathing is important because maybe somebody just conducted CPR or something like that. But like constant, you know, he sighed, he breathed, he looked, he noticed, he, you know, he turned, you know, lots of people that I know that will be like, hey, can you read this for me? And it's like, yeah, sure. The first thing you notice is he turned to, no, stop, stop.
Yeah. So no. What's interesting, I wrote a screenplay for a web series, and the director said, no, the turning, the breathing, all of that, he said, that's for me and the director of photography to figure out. We will determine if we go in close or we back up or someone needs to turn around. We'll figure out that.
Yeah.
If it doesn't matter for the story, don't do it. So, yeah, even in screenplays, they don't want it.
Yeah, yeah. And a really sharp editor will call you on it. You know, one of the pieces I did for an anthology was a dusted off short story I had written 10 years earlier. So I went through it. I cleaned it. I always go through an editor before I submit a short story. So I said, I'm not sure how this is going to look. Can you just tag this up for me? So the initial editor came back and was like, you know, a couple of faux pas here and there, but we think we fixed them. And the editor I was submitting it to is like a slash and burn type, but is very well known in the industry for her ability to really punch up someone's prose to make it powerful and impactful. So this woman also knows that I'm a soldier and that, you know, morbid humor is kind of built into the DNA when you come off the assembly line and go right through basic training. So she's like, you know, when she submitted it back, now this had already been edited by another editor, right? She said, I want you to know that in 8,000 words, you had 1,114 problems that I had to correct. You should print this out and either frame it or slap yourself with it. And one of the problems was in the first chapter, I had missed, because like I said, I had written it 10 years earlier. The first chapter of the short story, I had missed two instances of turning around, and obviously that got panned, and, you know, she tore me apart after that. But I mean, you know, the idea here was leave some of this to the imagination of your readers, because certain things don't need to be described. You know, you don't need to describe, you know, the wood grain on a door and like the clicking of the knob as it opens. If it has no bearing on the story, you know, save your page length and save your word count for those things that matter to the reader. We know what a door looks like. You know, we don't need to know it was a finished wood Anderson door with the, you know, gold inlay handles and all this other junk, you know, unless it's important to the story.
You know, somewhere the guy who writes Game of Thrones is shedding tears. Well, because that dude can spend pages just talking about food.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
But I would argue, number one, you're right. It's the right details, especially when you're writing for, you know, if your goal is mass market publication, you know, that's what they're looking for. But like George R. R. Martin, he's kind of got his own niche and he's been doing this for God knows how long. And people are reading A Song of Ice and Fire series because he paints these, want to call them tone poems, yeah. You know, where it's he kind of makes it feel like a lived in word. So he can spend a page describing, you know, the bowls of stew you can get in Fleabottom. Yep. In the capital city, because your audience gives a shit, and he writes well enough to, you know, to make him invested in those kind of details. But yeah, but
that's the other thing too. Yeah. That those bowls of stew at Fleabottom, those aren't extraneous details. That's meant to paint a picture of what life in that part of the city is like, and how hard and destitute it was, and, you know, that these guys weren't living, you know, paycheck to paycheck. Even they were living meal to meal. I mean, it was those details were important. You know, the fact that when he's talking about the stew, you know, that you never knew what kind of meat was in it, but you knew where the potatoes came from. And the potatoes were, you know, this thickening agent because, you know, there wasn't much meat to go around. And those kind of things mattered because it painted how desperate the people in Fleabottom were.
You know who I think is probably the master of that is Neil Gaiman.
Oh, yeah.
Stardust. He describes so many locations, gets so much narrative done in so many ways, and it's a short novel. But you feel every location feels so distinct for those kinds of details. He's really good at that. So,
you know,
Walt, I'm curious to get back on track with what the concept is. Take us through starting a book to get the moment from when you get the idea to when you start writing.
Hmm.
Like you get an idea. Okay, let's just come up with one. Sci-fi spaceship train heist.
All right.
What would you
space opera from
that to getting to the actual writing of it?
Well, if I'm doing that, I'm gonna start asking myself questions. Is it space opera? Is it hard science fiction? Is it space marine? Is it what is it?
Okay. Well, let's just say like I had Firefly in my head. But
all right, so quasi space opera kind of Western in space.
Sure.
At that point, I'm not even going to deal with the world. So no world building, no whatever. Right. I already know it's in space. I know I want it to be, you know, Firefly-esque, and that's it. First thing I'm going to do is I'm going to craft one of the main characters, and not just like, you know, he's this tall and this is his skin complexion, and it's going to be the other way around. I'm going to have a conversation with him and like some element. And if I'm going for something Firefly-esque, I think that right now on our train, on our space train heist, I'm going to have him that one of the scenes that's going to paint him in my head. He's going to be in an argument with a dock officer as why his ship shouldn't be impounded. You know, that's the first thing that sprang to my mind. Just that conversation, right? So that way I get a sense of his personality. Is he going to try and swindle the guy? Is he going to try and shoot the guy? Is he going to say, hey, you know, listen, I just need like another hour here because I'm just waiting for this car to get loaded. And, you know, he's actually in the middle of a job. And, oh, there we go. He's in the middle of a job. So now it's James Bond-esque. So, you know, and then it just goes with that scene. And once I got that scene in my head and I can kind of craft a little bit of what I want, then from there I'm just going to start sitting down right.
Oh, really? So you're not going to come up with like the main antagonist?
And... Nah.
Oh, really?
Nope. Okay. Sit down and write. Sit down and write.
Interesting. That's
so great.
Go on.
Oh, I was going to say the short story that that you can get if you go to my website is called The Lioness, and it tells in the book. The main book that's coming out, the Lioness is one of these characters that she's a Marshall's Templar, kind of like a Jedi, right? You get a few scenes with her, so she's not just a throwaway secondary character, but she doesn't get a lot of screen time in the first book. So I was like, you know, this is the first book is mostly told from the criminal's point of view. Let's let you behind the scenes to see what the cops look like. So I wrote this short story about them taking on pirates, like space pirates. And when I started, I didn't know the antagonist, I didn't know the protagonist, I didn't know whatever. I only knew that the main character or one of these characters from the first book in the series was going to be the star of the show. Right. Mm-hmm. So the first scene doesn't even include her. But I just sat down and I'm like, the first thing that went through my head was, should I start with the military crew that she leads or should I start with the pirates? And then I said, oh, I'm going to start with the pirates. And that's, I'm like,
so you're going off of where should I start? Not what am I going to write toward? What's the
end? Yeah. Yeah. And then I just sat down and wrote. That one is, I believe, 9,000 words, and I did it two afternoons, just slammed it out. And then anytime I finish something, I always take it and either read it out loud to myself or put it on my phone and have my phone read it. because you will catch like so many grammatical mistakes. Right. I can't tell you how many times the word solider hurt my ears. And then I whip up my phone and I get my drawing app and I draw around the freaking word. And I'm like, can't believe I spelled the word soldier wrong. Right. So, you know, and then you start refining from there. You know, it's just like when you're a sculptor, you have this thing that kind of looks like, you know, Michelangelo's David. The story was always there. The carving was always there. The statue was always there. You just had to pull it off the rough edges. So that story actually starts with the pirate crew waiting for the captain to come back from, like, you know, a meeting, setting something up. And then all hell breaks loose. But they're just sitting around playing cards, and you kind of get a little bit of – and I'm like, you know, I can tell – you can tell a lot about a person about the way they play cards, right? And I used that scene to tell about each person – a little bit about each person at the table, how they played the cards against each other and how they interacted with each other right before the captain shows up. And when the captain shows up, all hell breaks loose, and you realize these aren't the good guys. Right. So, and then the story goes from there. And then it was a lot of fun to write. I've gotten a lot of great feedback from it because, you know, we don't sell it. We just give it away to people who sign up for the newsletter. And then, you know, friends and people who want to check out the series before it's out. Kayleen Williams from Keystroke Medium did the audio narration, did a fantastic job, especially, One of the aliens that is in the pirate crew is a creature called a Hursk. You ever see the old Image Comics Pit?
Mm-hmm.
Imagine something that big and that nasty.
Oh, you know? Wow.
But he's when he's sitting down at the table playing cards from years of, you know, very poor shielding on the ships and stuff like that, he's nearsighted. So he's got these like tiny little things, like 9 feet tall. He's got these tiny little glasses. The rim of the glasses are bent wrong on his head because his head is so giant, barely fits in his nose because he doesn't really have a nose. And he's looking down at these cards and these little mitts. And it just goes to show you how, you know, here's this massive alien working amongst humans, human sized people. And he's got to try and fit into this society.
Great way to describe too. Part of the setting that your shields can fail, but also describe the alien and features without making it like, oh, he was this tall and had this color hair. Yeah. And boring as hell.
You know, it talks about, you know, I talked about his glasses and how they don't really fit because they were human glasses that somebody gave him. You know, the cards are human size. So he's got these giant taloned hands, right? The claws at the end of his hands are almost as long as human fingers. And he's trying to fan out cards, you know, and then he realizes one of his buddies is cheating, you know, but nobody cares that there's this massive alien that normally the race is known for being absolutely hostile. Nobody cares because he's such a like down to earth dude.
Right.
You know, because it's like when you're a trainer and like, look at those dudes in Las Vegas who train the tigers. They got mauled because they didn't read the animal correctly, because they'd been working with them for so long. They failed to remember it's a 1,300-pound animal whose only job in life is to look cool and kill shit. But that's the thing. During the opening scene, you're like, you forget that Marcodius, the guy who's sitting down trying to fan the cards and trying to have a good time with his friends, they're not afraid of him because they don't see him that way. And then you kind of see what the race is like as the story goes on. But it was a fun way to set up the scene, set up the setting, show off everything. And then when the space cops come in, how the population at large sees them, because the space cops that the marshals work with are they're attached to this basically religious organization, and the religion, if you call these people in to help you, they just take over. there's no like state police, like, you know, we want to work with the native organization and, you know, you just called us in to help and we're going to pool our resources. And no, it doesn't work like that. If you call in this religious order to help you stop a threat or whatever, when they bring their military in, they take over. And you see that when you're dealing with like the locals after the event happens. And then, like I said, it goes from there. So, yeah,
so
but
do
I wrote
you
that.
At any point make your characters like an RPG? D&D version of them?
Oh, yeah. Like write them out for just to see what they're like?
It occurred to me today because I write a lot of, even if I'm not writing superhero fiction, I will write, everyone's got powers, everyone's got something. And sometimes I see those abilities very clear and I don't need to. But like I've got a character right now, some version of seeing into the spiritual realm. She can see dead people. She can interact with them. She can also draw energy from those realms to cast magic and stuff that most people can't do. But it's her ability is unclear to me. And it occurred to me like just this morning, maybe I should write her up as a D&D character or something to get an idea of what her abilities are.
Now the I'm gonna hurt myself because it's gonna pain my soul to do this. And like, if you look at my back shelf, right up front and center, right there, we got the D&D alternate cover of the Supers rule book,
right there
standing up. And you could definitely do it in Supers, but one of the ways, if I really needed a character fleshed out, that I would do it would be champions, hero system. Granted, you'll burn 2 to 3 hours in making that character because those characters are very math intensive. Mm-hmm. The fourth edition was my preferred edition, but that is one of the most intricate constructions of role-playing game characters you'll ever see. And everything is statted out right down to like, if you got a cell phone, you can stat that out and have that, you know, all done in game mechanics and so forth and so on.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you could go on Drive-Thru RPG right now and grab that fourth edition book for, I think it's like on there for like $15.
I have the fifth edition, which
yeah,
one of the guys that's at my table loves champions. And I was always like, okay, here's what I want my guy to do. Go make them.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
The reason we left champions was, and especially for something like Supers, is because you're adjudicating something that should take 3 to 5 seconds in real time, and it takes over an hour and a half with 4 to 5 players.
Oh yeah,
on one action.
Well, you know, champions is a great game with the devoted fan base. Hey guys, how you doing? My experiences playing champions always remind me, like, if you're going through therapy to try to empathize with a friend or loved one who had OCD and you wanted to have an experience that would try to, you know, make you feel like what that's like. But I can totally see that. I mean, that's sometimes I set up characters when I'm writing just because it's a different part of the brain, lets you see different things.
Yep.
And, you know, sometimes it breaks
and
the law.
It also defines limits for your characters too. So like your character who can see in the spirit world, you know, at one point you're like, she could become a ghost as well. And, but, you know, does that break your story? Does that take the character in a direction you don't want to go? When you have it on a character sheet, this is what this character can do. And that's what the character can do. You know, you see in the like characters like Venom over the recent years, you know, keeps getting more powers and more powers and more powers. The symbiote can keep doing more and more. They just gave wings, for God's sakes, the other day. It was last year. You know, last year they gave him wings. And it's like every time you see Venom on screen, he's got some new ability that he can do, you know, and it's like, whereas you see somebody like Spider-Man, and when that character was created for like 30, 40 years, he did nothing new because everybody knew if you wrote Spider-Man, this is what he's capable of.
Yeah.
I mean, long form serial storytelling, they have to keep things fresh. But speaking of comics, I was reading Dan Slott on Twitter because I'm a horrible person who wastes time like that. And
you should be writing.
Yeah. Dan has a rule. It's the no double mojo rule. Any story just has one thing you have to buy into. So if you have a character who's a wizard, he's a wizard. Not a wizard and a ghost. Not a wizard and an alien. And, you know, it can, that might limit your genre mashup. But on the other hand, and it's, you know, everyone has their different rules, and there's some people who break that rule and are super successful. There's one lady
such as Radioactive Black Belt Hamsters, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, Zen the Intergalactic Ninja.
there's that lady.
I met the creator of Zen last year at a convention I was running security for.
Nice.
Great guy.
Yeah, I think just having rules, even if other people work better without them, just rules for yourself that, you know, just having that structure, which I guess gets back to our theme. Hey, it's all circular, pantsing versus outlining. And sometimes, you know, you need structure if you don't have an outline, because it gives you, you know, draws the boundaries on the field for you.
That's why I do the reverse outlining. So like I do a story Bible as I write. One of the things that when you're writing about like a space wizard force, you know, how powerful do you make them? Are the powers infinite? Can they do certain things versus others that they can't do? And like, I was very tight in the beginning, because the thing I like most about the early Star Wars movies is that the Force didn't do everything. It wasn't a Swiss Army knife that you just whipped out and, you know, suddenly here's a USB drive in my Swiss Army knife. Whoop! You know, I mean, it was very limited in what they could do, even though they had so much faith in it. And I liked that. So when I wrote my space cop wizards, I was like, yeah, I don't want this to do everything. And I want them to have limits. In the first couple of chapters, the main character gets effed up, dislocates a shoulder, breaks two ribs, possible fractured ankle. And that all has to be addressed. Like, yes, he's got these amazing abilities because, you know, at one point he's, you know, and I won't spoil it, there's a past that allowed him to do certain things, but it didn't do everything. And if you took a misstep or you faced overwhelming odds, you were going to get thunder humped. And that's what happens to him. He gets messed up bad. And the rest of the cast has to deal with that because they know they need him for something. So it's, yeah.
Yeah, there's a book in 2009, when I made the decision I was really going to go all in on writing and not try to be a comic artist, because I suck at drawing, but I had to admit that to myself. I went to San Diego Comic-Con and talked to a bunch of writers that were, you know, big names at the time anyway. I don't know. Is Bendis still writing?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Anyway. I talked to a bunch of people, and one of the books that everybody recommend, or a bunch of them recommend anyway, not everyone, was Plot and Structure by James Scott Bell. And that was my Bible for a long time. Because he goes off of, he kind of tries to paint this idea that it's for everybody. It's if you pants, if you outline, it's for everyone. And he gives a rough outline that he says, no matter if you pants, you want to know at least these things. And if you outline, you have to know these things before you can start more outlining. And he calls it a LOCK, where it's an acronym. And the L stands for lead. You have to have an interesting lead character. Then you have to have an objective, the O, what they want. And then the confrontation, what stops them from getting what they want. And then a knockout ending is something, the twist that in chasing the objective and then the confrontation, something threw it all out crazy. And he said that if you are going to pants it, if you know those four things, get after it. Yeah. And if you're going to outline, know those four things and then take each one and start to really work on it and mess with it. I found some success when the first novel I finished that I will never, ever, ever show anyone. It was the first one. I did a lock. And then I took that lock and I deleted all of the acronym parts and I wrote it out like a little synopsis. And then I read that and then I put it aside and I started doing the headlights method, where I wrote scene one and then I kind of wrote down where I thought the next two or three scenes were going. And then I wrote those scenes and just kept moving my car forward to the end of the story. And I when I look back at my story, it was 100% different than the lock. But I finished it, damn it. So it's valid. But yeah. It was interesting. But I also kind of feel like he had to say, to get a mass audience, that pantsers should use a lock, because he wanted that audience to pick up his book. when really it was a how-to outline book.
Yeah.
It was still very interesting. Whether you pants or not, I recommend it as much as I recommend Writing Into the Dark.
It's really that first idea though, that for somebody who like myself who's doing pantsing, that I know if I'm going to have an easy time with the story or not, you know. And one of the guys I've been working with recently on Super Secret Project Number 4, he said, "God, man, you give good pitch." And I'm like, well, you know, that's how I write, you know, get that, because I don't want to read something. I don't want to write something I don't want to read, you know? So like, always having that really interesting pitch, like, you know, John Wick in the middle of the Clone Wars, you know, or, you know, one of the things that I sent Mike about a game project that might be turning into a novel series was, what if we took this property here and put this that we like to game with in here? And you know, it's just because there's no new original ideas, you're just kind of mixing flavors to, you know, get the desired effect. I need to read your stories, Jacob. Hit me up in a minute and I'll hook you up. I got you.
That's the whole premise of Jade Punk. I totally get you.
Yeah.
Hell yeah. Western Wuxia mashup, because they're both interesting, but
awesome.
Let's put them together.
Let me say again, I love Jade Punk. I got the books over here right on my shelf. You know, I just the thing that captured me with Jade Punk was the art. And then when I started getting into like how the jade work, and especially when you did the supplement that talked about the different types of jade, I was just like, dude, this is phenomenal.
So you know? Jacob, I didn't do any of those supplements. Jacob, who helped me make the world, he did the supplements, the actual technical parts of it. But Benjamin Feehan, who used to write for Grapple Gun Publishing, I don't know what his role was, but he's one of the best writers I've ever met. And he has nothing for sale. It's a tragedy. That's his personal thing, you know. But he wrote all of the short stories in the beginning. And in the first couple, I kept saying, dude, the short stories for Jade Punk are one page. But with the stories were so good that I was like, screw it. Give them six pages. I don't care. it was just because it fleshed out the world so much. It actually pained me. The reason he backed the Kickstarter and he put a review after the first game he played with his table. He put a review on Google Plus about the game and the story and the characters and everything. And I was like, man, you understand Jade Punk better than I do.
Yeah.
So come write for me. And that was actually how it happened. But he did all of the stories of those, which was my favorite part of everything, because he made each one, the same character, gets into a new problem with the new color of jade. And you really dive into what that jade means. And he worked with Jacob on what's going to be in the book. And it was, yeah, those were my favorite too, but I didn't write them.
You know, I'm just going to pitch this to you occasionally. If you wanted to do a quarterly periodic Jade Punk zine with some more gaming content, maybe a scenario or a new rule or two, and throw in a short story there, people would buy it.
Yeah.
I'm not trying to sell you on the idea.
You know, I mean, you know, just to sweeten the deal, we could always do it for supers. And
dude, that was my thing. I was just thinking is I would totally be down making more Jade Punk stuff, but I don't like Fate anymore.
Have you seen?
I know this Fate audience. I can't get Fate anymore.
Have you seen Gary Brown's supplement for my game, Search and Destroy?
I have.
Do you have it?
No, you keep telling me you're going to send it to me.
I will send it to you right after this. Okay. So takes supers and brings it down to like the level of kind of like the everyman, so that, you know, it's not just people in tights. So his supplement takes supers and makes it adaptable to Bourne, Bauer, and Bond.
Oh, wow.
Right. But the mechanics of the powers are still there. So if you wanted to do something like Jade Punk, you could do that very easily. Hey, come here, you angry dog. You could do Jade Punk super, super easily. We just took this kind of rule set and adapted it to Galaxy's Edge, and we're going to be producing their role-playing game.
Oh, very cool. I was wondering when that was coming with how much
You are. Oh, yeah. Yeah, you knew that was.
Can you even talk about that? Is there someone going to jump through your window and shoot you? I mean, that's got to be NDA'd, right?
No, they can try. Let's see. I have within reach, I have an arsenal. So they're going to have a very rough time, A, approaching the window without the dog hearing them, and B, getting to my yard without, you know, something at least 300 grain jacketed hollow point traveling at about 2,000 feet per second.
Okay.
All right. Well, don't come after a while with your NDAs.
Yeah. I'm just going to say, you know, RPG zines are coming back. There's like two or three on Kickstarter right now. Kickstarter has their big zine quest in February.
Well, I just released one myself.
Oh, yeah, you did. We should show that.
Kickstarter?
No. I just released a zine for like old school style D&D, where because the thing I think that always ruins a game system is when you publish mountains of new rules for them. Mm-hmm. You know, it just mires everything, slows everything down at the table. It's just garbage. So what we did was we took we're just taking the thing that is familiar and twisting it on its head. Imagine a church military, kind of like the Knights Templar, who go out and find thieves and assassins to redeem. And when they do, they turn them into almost like a spy force.
So are you talking about, like, I'm just dropping my head around the zine. Are you talking about, like, the old Dragon magazine?
They used to have, like, organizations and character classes and stuff like that.
Just little collections of ideas that somebody had. I love that idea.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of people who publish a zine that's between 20 and 40 pages.
This one's 34 pages total with the covers. I got the proofs coming back to me hopefully this week. If you order a copy on drive-through, just send me a copy of your receipt, and we'll put that toward the price of the actual print.
You're printing them too.
Oh yeah.
Oh, yeah. Very cool.
Yeah, nice hard covers with glossy covers and nice pretty pages and, so little zines so that if you like stuff like Osric or first edition D&D, second edition D&D, you know, this will plug right into it, and it's something where you can put it into any campaign. You know, you don't need a huge backstory to plug this in.
Right.
So
interesting.
Yeah, a lot of fun.
I like the idea because I like shorter works. I like writing them.
Yeah, it's a thing you can finish. It feels good. Especially the Supers fan base would love to spend money on Kickstarter again. Here's a guy doing one. I just love the title. It's post-apocalyptic RPG zine. He's put out three or four this year called Scientific Barbarian. What a title, right? And he kind of goes all out. He's, you know, got mini adventures, some reviews, some comics. But, it's short, it's DIY, and it's...
I remember correctly, James Spahn is going to be having something in one of those.
Really? That's cool.
Yeah, I believe so.
Maybe that's how we should do that White Star project we've been talking about.
Just saying, you know, although...
I read White Star recently. I really dig it.
It's awesome. It's a great game, especially if you want to run something quick and easy. You don't have a lot of time to devote. Like, say your main game doesn't show. It's like, here, quick, let's put this together, and boom. Right on the table. Yeah. Although, Mike, I got to tell you, for that project that we've been working on, short stories, I submitted last week to the editor to get the story edited for you for the second one. Mm-hmm. And they were like, what's with this 4,000 word count? Dude, this is a chapter.
All right. Yeah, we should talk about it. But yeah, if you J-Punk for Supers as a zine, people would love that.
Yeah, they'd be, my God.
Just a thought. All right. Well, hey, I need to wrap things up. Get back to work. Ryan, Walt, always a pleasure.
Thank you. Week.
I'll do it a week or 2 weeks. What do you think?
You know what? I am going. I don't know when the 16th is, but I will be on a mountain and covered in snow.
That's awesome.
So I think the 16th is Wednesday.
Today's the 9th. So yeah, 7 days at 16.
Okay. So I will not be here next week, but after that, I'll be clear.
Okay, that'd be the 23rd. So I'll plan for that. All right. And to all our listeners and viewers out there on the internet, thank you for checking out the Banff Podcast, and we will see you next time.
Ciao.